Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
This guy has nothing. He's trying to find his way back into society. And may never be what he was. Mm-hmm. But they gave him 0%. This is how we treat our soldiers. We give them nothing. But they're good enough to go and sacrifice their life. And we give them nothing.
That's Annette McLeod, speaking of her husband, Wendell, who suffered a brain injury in Iraq. She also said doctors at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington told her her husband didn't try hard enough on a brain test. Hers was one of many voices raised today as the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform takes testimony on the scandal at Walter Reed. The hearings followed last week's stories in the Washington Post exposing deep problems at the hospital. But Mark Benjamin, national correspondent for Salon.com, has been reporting on conditions there for the last 2 years, and he joins us now with a briefing. And Mark, some lawmakers are expressing surprise at the Post reports, but Congressman Henry Waxman mentioned your Salon.com reporting today, saying it shouldn't be a surprise. So, first of all, why do you think it took so long to get the attention of Congress?
I'm not sure why it took such a long time for Congress to latch onto this issue. Among other things, I think it's amazing the number of soldiers that I've met at Walter Reed and other installations who have written to members of Congress raising these concerns makes me somewhat skeptical of the surprise that I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. But I think the story really has legs in part just because we're so late in the war. I mean, people are willing to accept, frankly, bad news stories about the way that we're treating veterans, and I think editors and reporters are more willing to write those articles now.
Right. Well, back to today's hearings, what else jumped out at you?
I think the thing that was very compelling was the vivid detail. I mean, it's the first time I think a lot of Americans will have to look these veterans and their families in the eye and hear these excruciating stories about how they can't get doctor's appointments, about how they're waiting months and months in these barracks fighting this bureaucracy that is supposed to financially compensate them for their wounds. I think for a lot of Americans, it's going to be very, very shocking to actually go and have to look these people in the eye.
Well, speaking of which, let's hear from another soldier who was treated at Walter Reed. He testified today, Staff Sergeant Dan Shannon. He lost an eye fighting in Iraq.
I want to leave this place. I've seen so many soldiers get so frustrated with the process that they will sign anything presented to them just so they can get on with their lives. We have almost no advocacy that is not working for the government. No one that we can talk to about this process who is knowledgeable and we can trust is going to give us fair treatment and informed guidance.
Mark Benjamin, any sense of separate oversight outside the military being set up for Walter Reed?
Well, there is this presidential commission. The president, during his weekly radio address this weekend, said that he would set up a separate commission that is supposed to do a top-to-bottom review, and it's going to be bipartisan, by the way, a top-to-bottom review of medical health care for soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and their compensation. We don't know exactly what the scope of that panel is, but it does raise the specter that there may actually be a hard look and what exactly has been going on, frankly, since these wars began.
Right. Well, Mark, there's also a discrepancy in numbers. In the minute we have, the Veterans Department had a low number of 23,000 injured, another number in the hundreds of thousands. Now, the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Jim Nicholson, who's a political appointee, told ABC's Bob Woodruff that that number, that second number, is so high because a lot of soldiers come in for dental appointments. First of all, in your research, is that true? And secondly, any sense that Nicholson will join the number of officials who've stepped down?
The data that Nicholson is referring to are soldiers that have come back from Iraq, they've gone to a military hospital, and they've been discharged from the military, but they still have health problems, and now they're going to a separate department, the Department of Veterans Affairs for Health Care. So certainly there are some people that are going in for, you know, dental appointments, as the secretary said, but there's also, and there's data on that, thousands and tens of thousands of people who are going in for things like treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, various injuries associated with combat. Now, certainly, those are service-related problems that were created by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think suggesting that somehow these people don't have problems because they went to war is, frankly, disingenuous.
And briefly, just any sense that he might go?
Well, there certainly is going to be a lot of focus on his role. Look for these inquiries to start shifting away from the military and towards the top civilians, both at the Pentagon and the Department of Veterans Affairs, to see why those people who really do run the programs, remember the military reports to civilians, didn't do more.
Right. Mark Benjamin, national correspondent for Salon.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today we want to spend a few minutes on another terrible story that's often difficult to listen to but instructive. Actually, two terrible stories, one of murder, one a cautionary tale about capital punishment. On June 10th, 1977, in Tyler, Texas, a young woman named Linda Jo Edwards was raped, murdered, and mutilated. Her roommate told police and others that on that night she saw a man in the apartment, but she didn't worry because it was Jim Mayfield, Linda's married lover, an older man with silver hair and white tennis shorts. So why was a brown-haired 20-year-old wearing red and blue shorts sent to death row for the crime? Well, the story of Kerry Max Cook's conviction is a story of coerced witnesses, police and prosecutorial misconduct, and a Texas good old boy court system. That, according to reporters and state officials who eventually investigated the case. More than 380 people have been executed in Texas since 1976. Kerry Max would certainly have been one of them, but after 21 years on death row, almost four trials, historically long appeals, and vicious jailhouse rapes, the state's highest court threw out his conviction in 1996. And then, in 1999, long-overlooked DNA evidence pointed to Linda's lover, Jim Mayfield, who's never been charged. Kerry's now telling his story in the book Chasing Justice, and he joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? First of all, I know you're doing a lot of interviews now, and that's not really new to you because you were also with the subject of a play, The Exonerated, that some might know about. But, I mean, the contrast between what I just read and your life now, it must be dizzying.
It is dizzy, but it's great. I thought the hardest thing I'd ever do in life would be survive Texas death row, but it was actually the writing of this book, the second hardest thing I ever did. And reliving, I mean, going back into that haunted house and confronting all those demons and having to write about it was extremely traumatic and difficult. But now here I am, and I'm hoping that my book will illuminate this issue and give it more of a face and perhaps change people's minds to see what's being done in their names.
Well, let's tell the story. You were 20-ish in 1977. You'd been raised by a military family in Germany. You were now living in Texas. By your own description, the cops had an eye on you. Why is that?
My father was a career decorated soldier, and we moved from Germany to the United States. It was a culture shock. It was very difficult for my brother and I, after having been raised on army bases across the globe, to come to a small East Texas town. And so
You were stealing cars?
Well, running away from home and taking cars with other boys just to get from point A to point B. And that got me in the NCIC computer, which is Law Enforcement's national computer. And once you get in, you never get out.
Well, it's a cautionary tale, Kerry, I got to tell you, because that is the backdrop of the whole story. It unfolds from there. The cops, you know, in many ways, thought they had your number. Let's go through the evidence they presented against you. A gay drifter testified that you had sex with him that night, that you both watched a slasher movie, and that you seemed primed for murder. And your fingerprint was found in the apartment of the murdered woman. Now, as we learn later, you did not have sex with the drifter, and you couldn't have watched those movie scenes with him because witnesses put you elsewhere. And most important, there was a reason for your fingerprint being in the apartment. You'd met Linda at the pool and gone up and, well, necked with her. But this was 3 days before she was murdered. Now, I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, why aren't you screaming? You know, this is why my fingerprint was there. You didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, my father told me upon arrest when they finally came to the Smith County Jail to visit me for the first time. My dad whispered and asked me, did I know her? And I leaned into the bars really closely. I said, yes, I'd been to her apartment. I knew her, Daddy. And he said to keep my mouth shut, that if I ever told anybody that I'd known her and been inside that apartment, I might as well have done it because they're going to pin it on me. And I just, My experience with law enforcement at that point, running away from home and getting in trouble, I believed it.
Yeah. We mentioned the roommate who initially described a man who looked like Linda's lover. Suddenly in court, she changes that testimony to that it was you, it looked like you, and coupled with a couple other things, off you go.
going to death row, not just prison. I'm going through the same diagnostic unit I did with the 2 years I got for a car theft, tried as an adult. But this time, I've got an escort, and I'm not collecting $200. I'm not passing go. I'm going straight into a white prison uniform, my head shaved, and I'm on my way to death row in the next 30 minutes. I'm sitting there in a death row cell.
Yeah. Oh, and it just is the beginning of a couple of decades. Endless appeals. At one point, you had the longest appeal in American history. You write about being viciously raped, having words carved into your body, attempting suicide several times. You came to some sort of, I don't know, understanding of how you might survive it all.
Well, my brother was murdered while I was on death row.
A random act of violence.
The man shot and killed him, shot once, missed, and ran up to him to make sure he'd kill him and shot him again, and this one severed his aorta and killed him. Then my father was dying and died of cancer. And you know, Robin, what it all boiled down to is, in the end, I had lost everything that could be taken from a human being except my very life, and the state of Texas was hell-bent on taking that. And so in the end, even though that was tragedy, and I was always tired, always worn down, always wanting to give up but knew I couldn't give up, in the end, it was my brother's murder and my father's death and my mom's insanity over it all that really motivated me to say, I can't quit no matter what. I can't give up. It can't be about you anymore, Carrie. It's got to be about them. They're laying in cold graves, being viewed as just the parents of a vicious, mutilating, homosexual, murdering, maniacal killer. Mm-hmm. And it drove me insane.
Well, slowly, reporters took up your cause, and then the group, the Centurion Ministries, stepped in, an advocacy group. Just tell us briefly, who are they?
They investigate claims of innocence intensely and meticulously, and when they determine that a person is completely innocent, they can't be accomplice, they can't be in any way involved in the crime for which they've been convicted, then they hire an attorney, they go out and secure exculpatory evidence, and then they put it in a writ and try to get you out of prison. They come into the prison system and hopefully bring the innocent person out of it, and as they did me.
And they're quite dedicated. And not only that, I mean, it was astonishing to read that there was somebody in California, for instance, that wrote a check for the cost of a trial, $300,000, which sounds like the low end of a murder trial. But without that check and without the lawyers provided, do you think you'd be here?
The fact is, my experience and long journey on death row taught me that sometimes the death penalty is brown, black, and yellow, but it's always green, and that's about the color of money you have. That determines who gets death and who doesn't and who goes free and who dies. The check that my benefactor wrote, it was a beginning that allowed me to fight the vast resources of the state. I went from a $500 defense to at least having some money to refute, say, the aging of the fingerprint. I could now bring a competent expert into the courtroom and say, hey, wait a minute, you cannot scientifically age a fingerprint they are advancing.
Yes, experts say it's scientifically impossible to determine the time of a fingerprint. The prosecution's so-called expert said that he'd aged yours.
He aged it to say I was there at the time of
the murder. We're talking with Kerry Max Cooke. He spent over 20 years on death row for a murder he didn't commit. His story was told in the play, The Exonerated. More with Kerry after a break. Robin Young, it's Here and Now, and we're back with Kerry Max Cooke, author of Chasing Justice, My Story of Freeing Myself After 2 Decades on Death Row for a Crime I Didn't Commit. That crime, by the way, being the murder of a woman named Linda Jo Edwards. And a warning, some of the details of her murder are gory. Kerry, we were just talking about discounted fingerprint evidence, but why else did the Texas Supreme Court eventually accuse police and prosecutors of misconduct?
They actually suppressed the evidence. It would have shown I was innocent, that the fingerprint was left 3 days before on a Monday. And also their own witnesses had told them that I'd met her at the swimming pool. I was an invited guest back to her apartment. They hid all of that and then went to trial and accused me of being a homosexual maniacal killer who left that fingerprint that was the calling card. And the only reason that fingerprint would have reason to be on that sliding patio door was the killer, because homosexuals aren't sexually interested in females. Then, to back that up, they brought in an inmate in jail for murder who had been in jail hopeless for 22 months at that point. And he cut a deal with the prosecution. He said that I'd confessed the brutal rape and murder, and he pointed out things before the jury very effectively, described aspects of the murder that, and the crime scene that only the true murderer could have known. And I knew that it was the police and the prosecutors framing me as a 20-year-old, because the only way that man could have known those things was he had to have gotten them from the police and the prosecutors. And sure enough, Shyster Jackson, the inmate, gets out, allegedly commits another murder, is being sought, contacts someone and says, hey, I'm willing to make a deal. I'll tell the truth about what I did to Kerry Cook, what the prosecutors did. I mean, I did have a secret deal, and but I want some immunity from prosecution, this new murder I'm being sought after for now.
So let's get straight. The inmate who testified against you got a deal, was released, murdered again. Then he does confess to you at one point. He does say to you, I'm sorry I did
this. Well, yeah, he confesses to the Dallas Morning News and others that they showed him the murder pictures. They coached him to make him an effective confession story. And it was only like almost 20 years later, he wrote my lawyers a note after a hearing, said he was sorry for what he had done. And there was a brief little note he wrote. He said, would you give this to Kerry? And it said, I'm really sorry for what I've done to you. I'm trying everything I can to correct the lie.
Well, and moving on in your story, even though the prosecutors and the police were being accused of misconduct, some of this false evidence is still being introduced in some of your trials. You're tried two more times. There's a hung jury, a guilty verdict. And amazingly, things happen like one of the juries in one of your trials is examining the pair of pants that the woman was murdered in. Now, we should say that part of the evidence against you was said to be that there was a stocking missing and that you had allegedly, this was a very brutal murder, you had cut up body parts and taken them away in the stocking. This jury, decades later, shakes these pants and out comes what?
The missing stocking that I had purportedly loaded full of body parts and carted them off into the night.
How can that be? That this is evidence in a murder trial. None of the prosecutors, none of the prosecuting lawyers, none of the police had looked at the pants? How can the stocking be there for 20 years?
Robin, it was extraordinary. I guarantee you the reason I'm here, the reason I have this book deal, I submit to you this is still going on today. How is it going on today? Because those same prosecutors will tell you today, if you turned around and went via satellite to Tyler, Texas, he's guilty. You know what? That's prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, you know, I want to ask you, do people say that to you?
I don't get that often. Recently, someone emailed me through my website and said, and it was a cop from Tyler. He said, you're guilty. You got caught with a vagina in your back pocket. And, you know, I knew that was from Tyler because...
That's what they said about you.
Yeah, that's some of the misconduct that they had put out, which caused me to be so brutalized in the Texas Department of Corrections. I was hated because of the way they made up elements of the crime to sensationalize it, to make me out to be a modern-day Hannibal Lecter.
Well, some of our listeners might be wondering why I'm not saying it, and it's because right before you're to be tried a fourth time, semen is found on the panties that Lindo Joe Edwards was wearing the night that she was killed. Again, it's amazing that this hadn't been looked at before. The semen on the panties is tested.
Yes, it belongs to none other than the original suspect, James Mayfield, the victim's married ex-lover. And this is the insanity of it all, and this is what happens. This is just what prosecutors do, Robin. They when they found the semen, it was going to be the final proof to show once and for all that I'd raped and murdered and mutilated Linda Jo Edwards. And, of course, it comes out 2 months later. It does just the opposite. They simply switch horses. They said it was inconsequential. So they were lovers. Big deal. That was insane.
It also turns out that James Mayfield's daughter is a well-known woman documented to be unstable. And 2 weeks prior to the murder, she had dressed up in a police uniform and gone to the apartment complex to interview people about the murder of Linda Jo Edwards by her father, James Mayfield.
Yes.
This happened 2 weeks, and the police knew this.
Oh, not only was it known, but finally in the 90s, she's called by the prosecution as a witness because they want to try to remove any reasonable doubt. And she first denies that that ever happened. She said, no, I never went out to the Embarcadero apartment complex dressed as a police officer. But it was a police officer that documented the incident and brought her into the police station and chastised her about impersonating a police officer to begin with.
It's just incredible. Carrie Max Cook, 2 decades on death row. I mean, how aren't you enraged?
No, I'm not enraged. It's a miracle that I'm here. But Robin, I've got a story that, you know, you've heard that old adage that the truth reads stranger than fiction. When you read this story, when you get to the very last page of this book and you close the book, well, then I can finally look into your eyes and say, welcome to my nightmare, because I not only live that, but I live that every single day, every time I do a radio interview, and they still continue to say that I'm guilty. That is the most mind-blowing, painful, horrific thing of all.
Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
I suppose it helps, too, that you got a little guy, a little boy. Married and you have a son and a family.
As I look in his eyes, it swallows up that past.
Again, Carrie Mack's books is called Chasing Justice. Well, a quick program note. Tomorrow, a reporter's notebook with the Christian Science Monitor's man in Baghdad, Dan Murphy. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, lobstermen versus fishermen in Maine. It's here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. As many as 2,000 lobstermen are expected to attend a hearing in Maine today to defend a state law, the only one of its kind in the nation, that says lobsters in Maine can only be caught in traps. Now, Maine fishermen, not lobstermen, want to change that law to be able to sell some of the lobsters they accidentally pull up in the nets they drag. They say they need to sell the lobsters because their industry has been ravaged, and indeed some of them are traveling to neighboring Massachusetts to do just that. But Maine lobstermen say the future of their lobster is now at stake. Joining us first on the line is lobsterman Mike Dassett. He's president of the Downeast Lobstermen's Association. Mike, why is this such a big deal to lobstermen?
A lot of it based on conservation. Back since 1998, we've had to endure trap reductions, our size increase on a minimum lobster, our V-notch zero tolerance.
What does that mean, V-notch zero tolerance? What's that?
Okay, zero tolerance means any female lobster that's been caught that has eggs on it, we have to put what they call a V-notch in the lobster and release that lobster. The V-notch indicates that that's a breeding lobster after she drops her eggs, and that V-notch will protect her for several years after.
So in other words, you're saying you guys have been conservationists and you've been stewards and you've been doing things to cut into your own catch to ensure you have a catch in the future.
Yes, that's the bottom line. 1961, they outlawed the dragging because they proved then it was having a bad effect on what was happening with the lobster industry. So between the dragging, the V-notch, our minimum size lobster was increased over a couple-year period. We had to let more lobsters escape from the traps. So we have really been adamant about a conservation measure to sustain our fishery for the next generation.
Well, but the fishermen are saying, you know, look, we only are asking to sell about 100 lobsters a day. I think that's what the proposed law would allow. That's about 500 per week, a very small percentage of the overall catch in Maine. And these are lobsters that they accidentally catch in their nets and have to throw back. What's your argument with that?
Well, the argument comes down, they say, well, it's only 1%. But they're allowed to take 6% total. But what this does, there's only a handful of boats that are going to Massachusetts selling the lobsters. What it would do is open up the entire dragging fleet in the state, from shrimpers, scallopers, urchins, all of these boats. My fear is that, well, once they do that, then they reach their 6%, then they're just going to start going back to Massachusetts.
Well, we'll speak to a fisherman in a moment, but the fishermen are struggling. I mean, as we all know, their stocks are depleted. Doesn't it help the whole industry, the whole marine life industry in Maine, if the fishermen do well?
Not at our expense. Back in the 80s, we had a terrible lobster fishery up here. I mean, I was hauling 300 traps a day, and if I got 100 pounds, I was highlining. I was making a living. So we've made our concentrated efforts to bring our fishery back. And the ground fishery had the same options back in the 80s and 90s. They could have gone to trap fishing for fish. They could have gone to hook and line. They could have gone to jig, just like what they did in Alaska. Alaska brought their fishery back in 12 years. But, you know, it's a proven fact that they chose not to do that. So it's kind of like we've raised our garden and we've made our garden. They want to reap from our garden. And I just don't see where that's right. I mean, my grandson and my granddaughter should have a right to go after it if they want.
Mike, I just want to ask you, how has this impacted, you know, the neighbor-to-neighbor aspect of fishing in Maine? I mean, this has turned into a pretty acrimonious fight.
Yes. I mean, for one thing, you know, 90% of the fishing in Maine is lobsters. You know, it's the second leading industry in the state of Maine behind tourism. And most of the people that come to Maine on tourism come to Maine for lobster. So we feel that if you take away that one aspect, you're taking away basically the backbone to the state of Maine economy. The bottom line is, if they want to catch a lobster and keep it, then I suggest that they use a lobster trap. That's the bottom line. We have no objection to them catching lobsters. We just want them to use a lobster trap.
That's Maine lobsterman Mike Dassett, president of the Down East Lobstermen's Association. Mike, thanks.
Yep.
Well, we turn now to Maine fisherman Brian Bechrist. Brian, you just heard Mike say that the lobstermen feel that you guys didn't do enough to preserve your own stock, and now you're encroaching on theirs. What do you say?
I just say it. I do a little everything. You know, I go lobster and I go fishing. I do a little everything. And I just see it tying the hands of the Maine fishermen because, you know, they can keep them every other state but Maine, and it just doesn't seem fair that the Maine boats can't keep them.
Well, you know, but you heard the lobstermen say that they feel that this will cut into their catch, that the nets, first of all, damage lobsters, damage the breeding grounds, tend to catch the lobsters. And we should say these are lobsters that are further out than traps can go. And these tend to be the larger lobsters, the more reproductive lobsters. So it's going to danger the future stock.
Well, if that was the fact, why are they out there catching them? You know, like I said, I think it's getting overfished out there lobster-wise.
How tough is it for a fisherman? I know we should say you do three types of fishing. You trap in the summer, you shrimp in the winter, and fish with a gill net in the spring, which is when you might accidentally pick up these lobsters. How much do you need these lobsters? Why does it mean so much to you?
It doesn't mean a thing to me. I mean, really, I won't get enough to make a difference, you know? But I just see the guys that do. I mean, there's a lot of boats, you know, the bigger boats. You figure if 500 and count it, at 3-pound average is 1,500 pounds at $6 a pound. That's a lot of money extra.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so yeah. You add that on to every trip with the price of fuel and everything else. It's quite a bit.
Do you think that if Mike just said the law passes, more fishermen will take the lobsters? That's their other concern, that right now very few do. But do you think that fishermen might actually switch to going out and netting lobsters if they're allowed to by law?
It might be a little, but it's if you put a size limit on it, I don't know what the exact rules are. I say you put a 2 to 3 pound limit, probably a 2 pound limit on it. So that basically keeps everything offshore. They can't come up in the bays and you know, close to shore and work on lobsters like they used to back in the 60s. That was the problem back then. They came in on the shores and worked on lobsters. That's why they made the rule. But if you put a 2 pound limit, that covers that problem. I don't know. I just think people ought to work together. Like I said, it isn't going to make a difference to me, but it's just like the cod fishing. You know, when they come back, I wish, you know, the lobster fishermen get a crack at them, because I think lobster, and it cycles. And no matter what they say is going to happen, I think it's going to go the other way. When the ground fish come back, the lobsters are going to go, and then lobster fishermen, some of them are going to want to go to the cod fish. And if they want a piece of that, they ought to give a piece of the lobsters to the guys with the nets.
That's Maine fisherman Brian Bechrist. We also spoke with lobsterman Mike Dassett. Both are attending a hearing in Augusta, Maine today on whether to change the law that's unique to Maine, which says that lobsters can only be caught in traps. You're listening to Here and Now. Spring ahead, fall back. By now, we're all pretty much used to that. But this year, the spring ahead is 3 weeks early, and the fall back is going to be 2 weeks late. Maybe you overlooked the paragraphs buried deep in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, but they say that this Sunday, you're to turn your clocks ahead an hour. Proponents say the change will save the U.S. thousands of barrels of oil a day and make people happier at the end of the day when it's light outside. But it's also going to mean waiting for the school bus in pre-dawn darkness. And U.S.-based airlines say they risk losing preferred landing and takeoff positions at international airports because they'll be operating on different schedules. And these aren't the only concerns. Paul McDougall is senior editor at Information Week. Paul, this is being compared to Y2K, when people were worried about technology turning over at the start of the new century. But there really weren't many problems with Y2K. So why is this different?
Yeah, well, I think with Y2K, businesses and governments took that very seriously, and there was a lot of time to prepare and take appropriate measures, so we didn't see many problems. The trouble with the so-called daylight savings bug is that it seems to have snuck up on people. We really didn't start hearing much about it until a month ago when Microsoft published a customer alert. So now organizations are scrambling. The effects are thought not to be perhaps as potentially serious as Y2K, but there could be some issues for businesses and governments that rely on systems with embedded clock time that won't recognize the change.
Right. Well, tell us some of those businesses. What's going on?
For instance, state governments seem to be issuing a rash of bulletins warning about potential problems, really ranging from pretty serious stuff to the truly mundane. Technology officials in Kentucky recently issued a bulletin warning that the bug could affect everything from medical records to transportation systems in that state. On the other hand, IT officials at Los Alamos, the nation's top nuclear weapons research lab, issued a bulletin to warn workers that as a result of early daylight saving, they may need to update their coffee makers. So there seems to be quite a range of anticipated impact.
Well, you do write about how different states are approaching this. For instance, Oregon seems to have really been going in deep in getting people ready. What are they saying?
Yeah, Oregon, actually, they surveyed their department heads to get a sense of how prepared they are for the switchover. The Oregon agency heads, on average, gave their departments a rating of 3.59 out of a possible 5 in terms of their readiness for the daylight savings bug. I'm not sure how they can feel that quite that precise about it, but I guess that's not bad. We'll wait and see.
Well, some of the problems that they warned about are automated security, surveillance, heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems.
Yeah, again, those would be some serious interruptions if there's an issue. So far, the potential for trouble here has maybe been a little understated.
Well, you also write about Pacific Gas and Electric Company in California. They had to get special permission to change the way they bill customers because the meters won't spring ahead.
Right. Otherwise, it would have cost them $38 million to reprogram the meters. So it's a difficult...
Wait, $38 million to reprogram meters?
Sure. We would have been talking about thousands of meters that workers would have had to go out to and reprogram individually. So for those kinds of devices that have embedded systems where the change is not easy, it could be quite troublesome.
Well, and yet, on the other hand, we're hearing from Massachusetts Congressman Edward Markey and others that this is going to reduce crime, save energy. So will the costs, you know, I don't know if you've had time to crunch the numbers, but will that savings maybe offset some of the losses?
Yeah, I think it's hard to make a calculation because until we actually experience the changeover, we won't really know how much trouble it will cause. I talked to a friend of mine last week who's a technology executive at a major insurance company, and he said, we kind of don't know what we don't know. It's a wait-and-see situation.
Well, you mentioned Microsoft issuing an alert. What about people's computers and home systems? Do they have, automatic changeover?
Sure. For home systems, it's not automatic, but it's a fairly easy fix. If you're on Microsoft technology, as most people are, simply going to Microsoft's website, you'll find a patch that can be downloaded and update most of your calendar systems and the operating system. Although if you're on the new Windows Vista system, you won't need to even do that because it's already the change is already accounted for.
Paul McDougall, senior editor at Information Week. Paul, thanks for giving us the heads up.
Great. Thanks, Robin.
Well, I have no idea what he was talking about, but I hope it means something to you. Stay with us. Jazz with James still ahead here and now.
Oh,
Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Quick news note. 2 decades ago, the record Don't Be Cruel launched Boston-born Bobby Brown into the stratosphere as a solo act. Since then, well, let's just say life's been cruel to the singer, and he was all over the entertainment news this past weekend after backing out of an agreement with a radio show. Starting today, Bobby Brown was supposed to appear on Washington, D.C.'s The Kane Show on Hot 99.5 FM for the week, because last week, the radio station sprang Brown from jail by paying $19,150 that he owed in child support payments. Brown had spent 3 nights in jail in Massachusetts after being arrested at his daughter's cheerleading competition. Well, now Brown says he never agreed to be an employee of the station. The money has been returned, and the station says it will do something else locally with it. No word on whether Bobby Brown will now come up with his child support. The sounds of Sonny Rollins, Saxophone Colossus from 1965. Rollins has made many, many recordings since he arrived on the scene in the late 1940s, and he's got a new one out. Here now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us to talk about new Sonny Rollins and some other colossal new jazz releases. James, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
You say there's something slightly different about this new Sonny Rollins disc.
Robin, I did tell you something about that, but It's nothing the fans will be able to hear. It's just that at age 76, Rollins has become an entrepreneur. Now, this new album, Sonny Please, is on Rollins' own label, Doxy Records. Doxy, incidentally, is the name of a tune Rollins wrote and recorded back in the 1950s. More important, this is just a very strong collection of Rollins' originals and standards. It's a collection of ballads and blues and, of course, one of Sonny's signature calypsos. On this album, Rollins leads a solid sextet, and they're with him all the way. And Robin, one more thing. I think that with this new album, Sonny Rollins has conquered what I call the Bob Dylan syndrome.
Okay, make the link between Bob Dylan and Sonny Rollins. This I got to hear.
Okay. What I mean by the Bob Dylan syndrome is that both Dylan and Rollins have made many, many recordings, maybe too many, over the years. When a new album by either man is released, I've noticed a pattern. The pattern is some critics are quick to write that this is the best work Bob Dylan or Sonny Rollins has ever done, but quite often it isn't.
Hmm.
Now, when their next albums are released, these same critics write, you know that last album I told you about, Dylan's greatest or Sonny Rollins' greatest? Wasn't really all that great. But this one, this is the bomb. This is the greatest. This is the be-all and end-all of Bob Dylan or Sonny Rollins' album. Kind of wears me out if you want to know the truth.
Huh. Well, and how has he then overcome that with this?
Well, I'm not going to say that this is the greatest Sonny Rollins album ever, but it is, from beginning to end, just a very good job by all concerned. Over the years, I've sometimes had a problem with Sonny Rollins' tone. On this album, it's more agreeable, at least to my ears. It's less astringent, and he's his usual witty self, strolling across the bar lines, moving in and out of tempo, and showing us why he's considered the world's greatest living improvising artist. All right, let's hear something from Sonny Please, this new Sonny Rollins album on the Doxy label. This is a Rollins original. It's a blues called Nishi, N-I-S-H-I. In this, and every solo on this disc, Rollins is telling us a story.
Okay, then, a very good Sonny Rollins CD.
Yeah.
No need to say more. Rollins, still vital at age 76. What's next, James?
Robin, I have a singer for you named Sarah Partridge. You've probably never heard of her before.
Wait, I think I love you.
No. Not from TV's Partridge Family. This is another Partridge, and not in a pear tree, by the way. Sarah Partridge is an actress, however. In fact, she was in the picture that made Tom Cruise a star, Risky Business. Small role, but she was in it. She's also done a lot of television work. And I think Sarah Partridge is a singer worth hearing because she's a no-frills, no-fancy-stuff vocalist. She sings from the heart, and there's no doubt that on her new disc on the Nagel Heyer label, You Are There is the title of it, but it's subtitled Songs for My Father. This album is across the board a heartfelt effort because it's dedicated to Sarah Partridge's father, who introduced her to jazz and died too young. This is a beautiful standard tune written years ago by the singer Frankie Lane and his accompanist Carl Fisher. Here's Sarah Partridge with piano accompaniment by Daniel May. The song is called We'll Be Together Again.
Someday, some way, we both have a lifetime before us. For parting is not goodbye. We'll be together again.
Sarah Partridge, again, not the Partridge family, but singing about her own family on the CD.
Yeah, you're right, and very lovingly, yeah. Very deep.
The new CD, You Are There. Okay, finally, James, you have a big band for us.
I do, Robin, and it's comprised of some of the best jazz players in New York, which of course means some of the very best jazz players in the entire world.
Okay.
I'm not being chauvinistic about New York, even though we're both from there.
That's right.
And we know that the real musicians are there.
There you go.
Anyway, it's led by trumpeter Charles Tolliver. He's almost 65 years old now, and he came to New York in 1964. It was there that he made his debut, his recording debut, on Blue Note Records with the late and indisputably great alto saxophonist Jackie McLean. Mm-hmm. Okay, Tolliver has returned with an exceptional orchestral work. It's also on Blue Note, and the album's called With Love. Tolliver composed all of the music on this album, with the exception of Thelonious Monk's great jazz standard, Round Midnight, mm-hmm. and Tolliver wrote all of the arrangements. And Robin, you know it's not easy to organize a large ensemble, even for just a record date. People have other commitments, etc., etc. It's tough to get them all together at the same time to rehearse and record. But Charles Tolliver did it, and it would be so wonderful if he could somehow manage to tour with this orchestra. Mm-hmm. All right, in any case, this bright Charles Tolliver original is the title track, With Love, featuring the leader's incisive trumpet and a very precise orchestra behind him. Charles Tolliver, With Love.
Charles Tolliver and his big band With Love from the new CD of the same name. And James, I just want to remark, a recent New York Times article said that while jazz CDs are not having their best sales, there's been a resurgence of teaching with Tolliver leading the way at the new school in New York. So lucky students there, huh?
Yeah, Robin, I saw that piece in the Times. Boy, are they lucky to have someone as musically acute and astute as Charles Tolliver, right. The trumpeter, orchestrator, composer, etc.
And James Isaacs always takes us to school when it comes to jazz. Thanks for tipping us off to these CDs. We'll list them at our website, here-now.org. James, thanks as always.
As always, my pleasure, Robin. See you soon.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.